Today's Taisho will be on case 20 in the Muwonkan. Case 20 is entitled A Person of Great Strength. Shogen Osho asked, why is it that a person of great strength does not lift his legs? And he also said, it is not the tongue he speaks with. Mumon's comment, it must be said that Shogen shows us all his stomach and his intestines. But alas, no one can appreciate him. And even if someone could appreciate him, let him come to me and I'll beat him severely. Why? If you want to see pure gold, you must see it through fire. Mumon's verse, lifting his leg, he kicks up the scented ocean. Lowering his head, he looks down on the fourth jhana heaven. There is no space vast enough for his body. Now, someone write the last line here. For coming to practice together on this beautiful Saturday morning. Everybody was sitting so deeply in the Zendo this morning. It was wonderful. A fairly large number of people came at 7, and some people came at 8, and many people came at 9:30. But when you practice together like this, it makes a huge difference, as you know. So thank you for doing such an excellent job. This koan is pretty simple, deceptively simple koan. Shogen Osho asks, Osho means like monk or priest, asked, why is it that a man or a person of great strength does not lift his leg? And or lift his legs. And no one could answer him, apparently, in the Zendo. So, you know, if you think about it, sooner or later, everybody has the experience of getting blocked. Graduate school. The year I started was a very good year for a job, new graduates, new PhDs. So I started graduate school in 1977, and I came into the graduate English program at the University of Washington, and all I heard about were all of these recent PhDs who had gotten wonderful jobs. And we were more or less assured that, you know, nobody said you're guaranteed a really good job, but we all thought, you know, we're in a very good place. You know, we have good professors. We're very likely to get our PhD and be professors at very good universities where we'll be happy and we'll be able to do what we want. But you know, actually, shortly after I started, there was a fairly severe economic downturn. By the time I had my PhD, which was in 1985, there were almost no jobs, I remember feeling really trapped, you know, because I had put all this time and energy into getting a PhD in English, and now, you know, I was writing letters. I wrote like 100 letters to different universities. And I would get these letters, very short letters, saying thank you for your interest in the position, you know. But you know, we have decided on to interview other candidates. So you know, let me say that I worked really, really hard to get my PhD. You know, I probably went during the school year. I had to always teach two sections, and then I had to, when I was taking classes, I had to take two classes. So if I wasn't grading papers, I was reading, and I was writing papers, and it would be like from dawn till dusk. You know, I was grading papers, reading, and writing papers day after day after day. And it's true that in the summer I had a summer job where I had a little break, but even in the summer I was reading for the next year, right, trying to get ahead. And you know, if I had negative comments from my professors, I took them really seriously, and I would work even harder. And I remember my friends in the Seattle Zen Center, when we would finish a sesshin, a lot of them had control over their time. So one of my good friends, John Godfrey, Eshin is his Dharma name. He's now the head of the Vancouver, BC Zen Center. And he's done very well. He's a wonderful man. He's a very large New Zealander. You know, John, after sesshin, John would I'd say, John, what are you doing now? And he'd say, he had a New Zealand accent. He said, well, Kurt, you know, we're going up into the mountains, you know. And he would just, you know, he was a computer programmer at a time when computer programmers were so hot. In fact, you know, he used to tell me that people would call him up trying to get him to do programming for them, and he would not want to do it because he was so busy already. And he would say, "No, I can't do it." And they'd say, "Please, you know, what? Just tell us what your price is." And he said he would make a price up, thinking it would discourage them, and they'd say, "Done." So that's very different from English graduate students. So, you know, John, at the end of sesshin, he had like a very nice car, and he and some of the other members of our group would be going up to, if we were in a remote location, they might be staying or going to a place nearby and camping out or something. And I had other friends, and they had plans. And as soon as sesshin was over and I got home, it was like, get to those grading those papers, reading the next chapter, you know, trying to get the paper done. And it went on like that for year after year after year. So, you know, when I, after seven years of that, you know, I had expected at the end of this process that somebody would, you know, I would write a letter and somebody would say, "Oh, you know, you have just the qualifications we're looking for. You know, you've done such a good job. You're such a good boy. Here's a job," right? And I wrote, computers, by the way, were very marginal. Almost nobody I knew had computers in these days. So you used to have to type, you know, if you had to type 50 letters, you had to literally type 50 letters. And I remember there was one guy in the English department, Leroy Searle, who had built his own computer, and he was on my dissertation committee, and I went in to see him, and he was showing me his new computer, and I was totally uninterested. I thought, what a waste of time, you know, that'll never catch on. So I just thought, why is he wasting his time with this, you know, ham radio or something, whatever it is. So, at any rate, I was so disappointed that I didn't get any jobs. And I wrote 100 letters with a typewriter. So I typed 100 letters, and I would get my materials. It was like a little production line. I had my CV, I had a sample article, I had my letter, you know, I had a master letter for this kind of job. I had this letter for this kind of job. I had this letter, and sometimes I hired, like typists to do the typing for me if I didn't have time, but it was expensive, right? You know, so I sent out 100 letters, and in my field, you have to go to a conference to interview for the jobs, and it's very expensive to go to the conference. I think in those days, you know, I probably made about $6,500 a year, and going to the conference cost more than $1,000, right? So just a huge amount of your net went just going to the conference. And the first year I went to the conference, I interviewed at two places, and I realized they weren't really interested in me. They were just interviewing me because they needed like 10 people on the list, right? You know, and that was very. And I remember going home and just thinking, you know, I feel totally trapped. You know, I don't know. You know, I feel totally trapped. And I'm sure you've had that experience, right? Where you know, you want something, and you want it, you know, wholeheartedly, and the universe just isn't giving it to you, right? That's one form of being trapped, right? There's other ways of being trapped. You know, just to take another example. Well, my brother had a very unhappy marriage, and he and his wife, if you ask me, are too much alike. I'd tell you the truth. And their marriage was very, you know, there was a lot of passive-aggressive energy in their marriage, and so they weren't the kind of couple that would get upset and scream at each other. But they would. It was passive-aggressive. There was always this atmosphere of a submerged tension in their relationship. And as a result, you know, they had two children, and the older child, my nephew, developed kind of a stutter for a while. They had to send him to a class to deal with his stutter. And I think, personally, that it was just the atmosphere of the home was so tense and unhappy. And there was like this tension under the surface. It could easily erupt. And I remember when my brother got sick, you know, he got cancer, I went to visit him. I stayed for about 3 days with my brother and his family, and I was so amazed at how unhappy his family was. And I had asked Peter, you know, why don't you get divorced? You know, you and your wife are so unhappy. And he said, I can't. You know, he said, you know, I don't want to lose my children. I want to be close to them, and he was beginning to have health issues, and he didn't. There were many problems, so he was totally trapped. You know, he was in a relationship that was unhappy, and he didn't see any way. He and his wife had gone to therapists, and it just wasn't working out. And I know he must have lay awake at night and thought, you know, I'm just totally trapped. You know. There's other ways of being trapped too. You know, you can be in a job that you really hate, but you know you need that paycheck every 2 weeks. I certainly have friends who you know don't like their work, and they drag themselves to the office, I actually have friends who are teachers who really should have retired a long time ago, and they're very, you know, they don't have the savings that would allow them to retire. And they feel very trapped. They'd like to be free. They'd like to be traveling, but they're just back in their offices doing whatever, you know. This is a common human experience, you know. You know, if you pick up a magazine or you read on the internet obsessively, ads will pop up for travel. Or the other day I was just reading the New York Times travel section, which I really enjoy. And there's a guy in the travel section who, I can't remember his name right now, but he's been going all over the world, and he has been writing a series of columns about the Balearic Islands and, you know, these out-of-the-way places that are really magical places. And, you know, you read something like that and you think, oh, you know, he goes here, he goes there. His editor loves his work. You know, what a lovely life. And here I'm stuck. I'm trapped. I'm in this job. I can't leave. You know, I can't leave it because I need the money. Or I'm in this relationship and I can't leave it. So I think this experience of being trapped is quite common. And when it happens to us, when it happens to us, it's a terrible feeling, right? To know, I can't get out of this. I don't see any way out of this. And our culture is constantly telling us that, you know, we have all this freedom. There are all these opportunities for us. And yet, you know, in our personal lives, we may not feel that way at all. We may be just hanging on by a thread, and we might wish that we could be in a different relationship or a different job. Or a different life, and this, as I say, this is really common human experience, and it's happened to me many times. Right, even when I was in college, I had a summer job that I absolutely hated. It was working construction for a guy who. I hope you won't take this the wrong way, but I had a job in Northern Virginia working for a man who was really like a redneck. He was, I'm sure he's long gone, but if he were alive, he would have voted for Trump. And I had long hair, I was a hippie, and I had to do construction work because I needed to make enough money to get through college. And as soon as he saw me, he hated my guts. And he would yell at me every day, and he was really abusive. He wasn't physically abusive, but he was verbally abusive. And he would give me the worst jobs in the world, right? These terrible jobs. One time he gave me it's like a crowbar, basically, like a giant crowbar. And my job was to chip away at this rock so that the plumbers could put a piece of pipe through. And I was cheaper at $3 an hour than renting a jackhammer. So he gave me a hammer and a crowbar and just said, the water has to run down. Your job is to make a trench and the water will run down. And like 2 days later, my hands were, you know, covered with blisters, and, you know, I was making like this tiny little trench, progress on this trench. But I wondered later, why is he doing this to me? But it was just, it would have cost so much more, you know, he was paying me like, $40 a day, 40 some dollars a day, you know, the machine would have cost more than that, you know, so just use this hippie. And I wanted to quit so badly, but I wanted to get back to college, right? So anyway, this experience of being trapped is a common human experience. And it happens to all of us. And if you think about it, when you're in that situation, there really is no way out. You know, that's the thing. And our culture doesn't really give us any equipment to deal with being trapped. In fact, if you know, it tells us the opposite image of ourselves, right? It tells you the opposite. And in fact, even in our religion, you know, for a while, I lived in the South. My father was a naval officer, and we were stationed in Virginia, in the naval, he was stationed at the Naval Weapons Station. And on Sunday, on TV, there were all of these religious programs. And I remember as a kid watching these religious programs with interest, some interest, but also I didn't like them very much. And they would feature like somebody who had illness, like a serious arthritis, some crippling illness, would come up to a preacher and, you know, with the crutches. And the religious person, the holy man, would put his hands on this woman's head and she would fall back and then she wouldn't need her crutches anymore. And millions of people in the United States believe this, right? Another version of this is a lottery, right? Lottery tickets. I myself don't buy lottery tickets because I just doubt I'm going to win, you know. But my wife buys a lottery ticket periodically. And it's harmless, right? It's harmless. But it's like... you're going to buy this ticket, you're going to take it home, and somebody does win. Somebody wins, and their life is totally transformed, right? So, you know, a preacher puts his hands on your head, and suddenly you're totally transformed. Or you buy a lottery ticket, and you're totally transformed. Or, you know, people will talk about experiences in their life where, you know, I was down, I was out, I didn't have a penny, and then this happened to me, and I was totally transformed. And I'd like to say that I think that's a very false view of how people are liberated, you know? I really personally don't buy the stories of one single moment that totally changes people's lives. I think it's very much part of our culture to believe that. But I think it's very misleading. You know, the people who buy lottery tickets are mostly poor people who are trapped in their financial situation. And they buy lottery tickets because they're hoping that there'll be this single turn of the universe that will set them free. And I would say that they really are trapped, you know. So when we get trapped, you know, a lot of our culture tells us to look for an experience that's going to be totally transformative. So, you know, my brother did this. He was having a lot of conflict with his wife. And at one point, my brother, I have to say, was a very, you know, basically he voted for Ronald Reagan. That says a lot about my brother. And... very conservative person in general. But he and his wife went to Europe, which was sort of like, what? You're going to Europe? And they went to Europe hoping that basically they would have this experience that transformed their marriage, right? They'd go to Europe, they'd suddenly realize that, you know, all of this conflict was unnecessary and they really liked each other, and they would come back and all would be well. But of course that didn't happen. You know, when they got to Europe, there was more conflict, right? And they came back, I think, more discouraged than when they left. So, you know, I think the image of everybody has this experience of being trapped, and then our culture tells us to look for that moment. In fact, there's even a name for this in like literature called epiphany. The epiphany, right? That moment when everything's going to change, you're going to see clearly, and so on and so on. I have to say, I don't believe such moments exist. I really think that's a fantasy, and I don't think it's a good thing for people to believe that. You know, I think that change takes time and effort, and it happens, it can be huge, but it happens very slowly. You know, it happens like one instant at a time. One instant at a time. In Zen, we have this term for an instant. It's called a nen, N-E-N. You know, change happens one nen at a time. And it doesn't happen dramatically. it happens just like a little bit, little bit. So, you know, when I was in graduate school, and I put all of this effort in, and I was so unhappy, right? I felt so trapped because I wrote these 50 or 60 or 100 letters and nobody wanted to hire me. And I went out on the job market and came back and nobody wanted to hire me. You know, I didn't know what to do. I spent a lot of time at the Zen Center. And I did a lot of sitting. I probably did more sitting than I had done in my, you know, Zen career. And I'd done a lot of sitting. But, you know, I would have this experience where I would be so mad at my situation that I would, like, walk around, you know, the university district in Seattle just, like, talking to myself, almost like a nut, you know. And because I was just furious. I felt like the English department at the University of Washington had cheated me. You know, these professors, I liked them a lot, but they had cheated me. You know, I thought I was going to get a job, and they had wasted my time. And you know, a friend of mine was a doctor, and at the end of medical school, which is about the same length of time, nobody said, well, you know, surely we don't need any internists, you know. She got a job right away. You know, so I felt like this is such a, you know, such a ripoff, such a fraud. But, you know, I would sit down on the cushion, and I would watch my breath for like two or three periods of sitting. And at the end of that, I would feel just a little bit better. You know, and that's why I started to do a lot of sitting. I would sit down on the cushion and feel just a little bit better. You know, I wouldn't, you know, sit down on the cushion and suddenly, my God, you know, life, you know, that it didn't happen like that. You know, how lucky to be alive I am. I did get to that point, but it wasn't like one sit and boom, right? I think people come here sometimes, beginners come here expecting that. You know, but what happened was I would come in and I would sit down and I would be really in a bad place, really agitated. And then, you know, after like three sits, I would be, you know, it would be like I'd be okay. And, you know, then I would come back, you know, the next morning and sit again. I was sitting like every morning at the Zen Center. And, you know, I was okay. It was like little by little, I was abjectly miserable. And then little by little, I was less miserable. And then little by little, I was not so miserable. And then little by little, I was okay, right? And then little by little, like one breath at a time, you know, after about a year, I was sort of happy. You know, I had begun to make plans like, well, I don't need to have an academic career, you know. I began to send out job letters to, like, companies in Seattle that needed technical writers, and I had taught technical writing. I began to imagine myself living in Seattle with the Seattle Zen Center, which I love so much, instead of going off to some other city, you know. But it wasn't an overnight, it was a process, and it took work on my part, you know. And, you know, if you think about it, you know, the way Buddhism looks at time is very interesting. You know, when you sit down on the cushion, if you meditate long enough, you'll notice that time, or at least your awareness, is not a straight line. It's actually a series of little flashes. It's a series of little flashes. So, you know, basically consciousness is not, it feels like it's continuous and unbroken. We say stream of consciousness, but it's not a stream of consciousness. If you meditate for about 10 years, one day you're going to notice, maybe it's a little longer, maybe a little less, you're going to notice that there are interruptions in each moment. So it's like there's a moment, and then there's nothing. And then there's a moment, and then there's nothing. And then there's a moment, and there's nothing. And then there's a moment, and there's nothing. This is how reality appears to very advanced meditators. And if you persist, you will notice this. We'll be sitting one day and you'll realize it's like a movie. You know, in the old days, movies used to be on reels of film. And sometimes the reel would slow down. And, you know, when you're watching a movie, you're seeing a series of pictures flash on a screen at a very high rate of speed. And there are gaps between each picture, but the gaps are so small that your mind just doesn't notice them. If the projector begins to slow down for some reason, and the film stops moving through the lens, you know, through the lamp, you begin to see the isolated images on the screen, and it begins to the images begin to stutter. It's like a flash, and then there's nothing, and then there's a flash. And maybe this has happened to you. It might be from the past now, because so much of this is digital. But reality is actually like that. Reality is not a continuous stream of moments according to Buddhist thinking. It's a series of instants punctuated by nothing. And actually, that's how we live our lives. A series of very small instants. It's like flash, nothing. Flash, nothing. Flash, nothing. That's actually how consciousness works. And maybe reality. You know, there are physicists who actually say the universe is pulsing like that. It's oscillating. The universe is oscillating between something and nothing. And if you've been practicing meditation long enough, you would definitely say, oh yes, I've seen that. It may just be the way the mind works, but it might be the way the universe works. But, you know, when we think of time, we think of a flow. Or if we think of consciousness, we think of a flow. But actually, there is a flow, but it's experienced one like microsecond after another, one little instant. And in that instant, how you respond to that instant has a big effect on how you will respond to the next instant. See? And how you respond to that instant will affect how you respond to the next instant. You know, the word for this is karma. Karma. So basically, you can't change your life all at once by having somebody put his hands on your head and say magic words. And you can't really change your life all at once, totally, by winning a lottery ticket or going on a Hawaiian vacation or a European vacation. You know, the way you change your life is a little less exotic than that. It's one breath at a time, one nen, one moment of consciousness at a time. And if you've been to Sesshin, and if you haven't, I hope you will someday, but if you've been to Sesshin, you know that's how around day three people get through Sesshin, right? You know, around day one, if you haven't been to Sesshin before, and you come to Sesshin, you might have a fantasy, right? That you're going to come to Sesshin, and around the second day of Sesshin, you're going to be meditating, and all of a sudden, there'll be this flash of light, and you'll be enlightened. And you'll go in and you'll see the teacher, and you'll say, Roshi, blah, blah, blah. And the teacher will go, my God, you've done it. You know, you're enlightened. I had that fantasy. When I went to Sesshin, I had read all of this nonsense, you know. I had read all of this stuff that was, I had read somebody called Carlos Castaneda. I had read this phony, not even a Tibetan writer named Lobsang Rampa, who claimed that Tibetan lamas communicated through telepathy, you know. I was ready for anything. And I thought I was going to go to this Sesshin, and on day two, Genki Roshi was going to go, Tani Roshi, my old teacher, reincarnated. It's so wonderful to see you, right? I didn't believe it, but I had fantasies like that, right? I was going to go to Sesshin and one sit would be a total liberation experience, or one Sesshin would totally change my life. You know, and but by and many people come to Sesshin with that idea. But you know, around day three, we have many fewer thoughts and projections, and we're much closer to being able to see the truth of our situation, because we've cleared away so much of the illusion. And on day three of Sesshin, you know, you realize the sitting period is about to begin. And it might be 30 minutes long, and all I have to do is get from one breath to the next, right? So, you know, when you're sitting on the cushion on day three of Sesshin and I ring the bell, you realize I can't really tell how long or short 30 minutes is going to feel. And I can't make Kurt ring the bell at 25, and if he decides to go on to 35, I can't really stop him. So what I'm going to do is just, and that is life, right? That's just like life. I can't control this situation. It's out of my hands. You know, I can't make the sit longer or shorter through anything I do. But I can watch each breath very carefully and attentively, mindfully. And fully, right? And so you watch this breath and you follow it out until it's gone. And then you follow the next breath. And then you follow the next breath. And what you're really doing is bringing your attention right to the front of each moment of consciousness. So when you're really meditating, you're in the what we could call the first nen. The first nen, the front of each moment of consciousness. You're bringing your attention right to the first nen, and then you're not dwelling on the second and third nens, you're coming right back to the front of the next moment of consciousness. See? Every moment has a structure. There's the immediate experience. That's the first nen. Then there's a kind of self-awareness. You say, I am experiencing this. And you start thinking. And then the third nen usually involves some kind of an emotional character. So every moment, those little micro moments of consciousness have these three elements to some degree. And when we're meditating, we're really bringing our attention right to the first nen, the front of the moment. And then we're not paying any attention to the second and third nens. We're going right to the next moment, see. And when we do this, this is really liberating. This is actually changing our karma, see. Because, you know, it takes a few days of sitting. You know, you're thinking, oh, you know, woe is me. I put in 8 years into my profession and I can't even get a job. Now I'm going to have to drive a taxi cab in Seattle. I didn't have to go to graduate school to drive a taxi cab. You know how unfair life is, right? And then, you know, but and the more you think that's karma, right? The more you think, God, life is so unfair. What a raw deal. You know, I hate this place. You're creating your karma going forward, right? Your negative thinking is poisoning your experience of moments that have not yet arrived. And when you sit down on the cushion and you watch the breath, you just try to get through this moment and this moment and this moment. See, you're liberating yourself from your karma. All that negative, all the evil karma, you know, that you've acquired is burned away or transformed, but only moment by moment. It's literally one microsecond at a time is how we change our lives. And from the Buddhist standpoint, there's no other way. You know, I couldn't control the job market in 1985. I couldn't control the economy. You know, I actually didn't know that the area of research I was doing was considered old-fashioned. you know, and that it would be hard to get a job doing a dissertation on the subject I chose. I didn't know that. Nobody told me that. I had no control over any of that, right? And you know, my brother had no control, actually, over his marriage, believe it or not. When I met my brother's wife, I thought she was a wonderful person. I almost worried about her because, you know, I thought she was much nicer than my brother, you know, and she was, you know. You know, my brother got into his marriage with the best of intentions. He didn't understand himself, and he didn't understand his wife, right? And it turned into this very painful situation. It couldn't have been different. It couldn't have been different. You know, on their wedding day, it was a sunny day. It looked like this is going to be a successful proposition. You know, when I went to graduate school, I thought, I didn't have a boring day. Every day I was doing research on my subject, I was interested. But at the end of it, I couldn't get a job. I didn't see it coming. And I couldn't control the outcome. I couldn't lift my leg, see? You know, we all have this experience of being trapped. And when we're trapped, you know, what we want to do is find that thing, the lottery ticket, the revivalist preacher, you know, heroin, you know, whatever. You know, countless people selling snake oil in the world, right? But what we really have to do, at least from the Buddhist standpoint, is transform our karma. And that happens nen by nen, micro moment by micro moment on the cushion. You know? And so we don't have, you know, humans don't have control over their lives. And anybody who thinks that he or she has control is living in an illusion. And Americans love that fantasy, right? We say, we can make it happen. We can do it. You know, we have this can-do spirit. And it's a fantasy, right? I remember there was a certain president when we invaded Iraq who said, mission accomplished, right? We pulled down Saddam Hussein's statue, and that was supposed to be a new day for Iraq. And I was just reading the other day that most Iraqis wish that had never happened. They didn't like Saddam Hussein, but they wish that had never happened. You know, we are overly optimistic about what we can control. In our lives, we can actually control very little, actually. And that's a bitter pill to swallow, right? But on the other hand, we do control our consciousness. And we can control how we will respond to the events that overtake us, which are beyond our control. And in that way, we can change our karma. And if we change our karma over time, microsecond after microsecond, we become totally transformed human beings. But it doesn't happen miraculously. It happens, you know, with a lot of hard work, second by second. You know, the Dalai Lama said that the purpose of Buddhism is the total this is something I totally agree with. He said, the purpose of Buddhism is the total transformation of the human being. And he's right. But that total transformation of the human being takes place one nen at a time, one breath at a time. You know, so you something is going wrong in your life and you say to yourself, you know, I hate this, you know, I hate this, you know, and this is so unfair, this is so wrong, you know, or, you know, it's possible we actually are going to wreck the planet. And as you contemplate this, as you read about this in the paper, you know, you may feel like you're in a bus that's going over a cliff and people are screaming, turn away from the cliff. And the driver, of course, has orange hair, right? And he's not turning away from the cliff. That is the human predicament. This is not the first time this has happened. And it is true. You can't necessarily, you do your best, but you may not be able to turn the bus around. It's a big bus. But what you can do is sit down on the cushion and liberate yourself from your destructive mental habits. And that happens one instant at a time. It's like in a common Zen metaphor for this is water, drops of water wearing away a stone, right? And, you know, basically you see the Grand Canyon, you know, to use a cliche, and that the Grand Canyon was formed one drop of water at a time, you know, slightly eroding the sandstone floor of the Grand Canyon. And over a vast amount of time, you know, a deep time, you know, this magical place was created. And that's actually the only way change happens. So when we sit down on the cushion and we watch our breath, you know, at first we may want all kinds of things to happen, but they're only going to happen on the scale of one breath at a time. So, you know, if you're feeling trapped, you're feeling helpless, you're feeling angry and alone, you know, you may be. But the question is, how are you going to respond to that? You know, how? Because if you respond in the proper way, it becomes, you know, these become stepping stones to your liberation. And if you're an awakened person, you can help others in a way that you can't if you're not, right? So you sit down on the cushion and, you know, you watch the breath, and after half an hour, you feel a little less bad. And then, you know, you make a point of getting back on the cushion and doing it again. And moment by moment, you know, how you choose to respond to the next micro moment affects how you will respond to the one after that, and the one after that, and the one after that. And you can't know who you will be at the end of this process, because that's uncontrollable too, right? But you just make the best of the instant in front of you by being 100% present with it, right? And so you watch this breath, you watch this breath, you know, at Sesshin, you come to Sesshin and you think, I'm going to have enlightenment, or I'm going to answer my koan. And by day three, it's not really clear you're going to answer your koan, and it's not really clear that you're going to have enlightenment. And the pain in your legs is pretty significant, so you're just going to try to get through the sit. And you watch this breath, and you watch this breath, and this is a karmically transformative process. Because you're harmonizing yourself with the way, with the great way. You're emptying out your desire to control, and you're making the only choice you have, which is, how will I respond to this next minute? Will I respond to it with hands, palms together? Or will I respond to it with anger and fear and so on and so on? And if you say, okay, I'm just going to be present in a non-judgmental way with this moment, and I'm going to be present in a non-judgmental way with this moment, and I'm going to be 100% present with this moment. You know, after a few days of sitting, you may feel real joy. And this is so common, right? This is part of the common meditation experience, you know. And you might say to yourself, why am I so happy? Because nothing has changed, you know. But something has changed. It's your relationship to the world, you know. And if you're not paralyzed by anger or fear or disappointment, you know, it makes a big difference in the way you can interact with others, you know. Yeah, I think I mentioned this last time, but one of the books that made a big impression on me when I was young is called The Plague by Albert Camus. And it's about a city where the plague has broken out, and the French in Algeria, and the French government, I think the town is called Oran, O-R-A-N, and the French government has closed it off because they don't want the plague to spread. And this was before antibiotics, right? And everybody in the town is trapped with the plague. There's no way out. And all of these people go through different things. You know, some people throw themselves into the libertine life, have orgies or drink from dawn till dusk. Some people, you know, turn to the life of crime, which is really pointless, right? Some people use drugs and, you know, and other things, but some people eat banquets every day, you know. But the man in the story realizes, you know, he's going to use his time to try to help other people. And I remember there's a scene in there where this little boy has plague and is shrieking in pain, and the doctor says, you know, the universe doesn't care about this little boy, but I'm going to care about this little boy. You know, I'm going to take care of all of these people who are suffering. You know, and I don't know what karmic forces produce that person, but we can all be that person. We can't not make, you know, if the plague comes, the plague comes. You can't stop it. But what you can do is be present with it in a way that will be liberating for everyone involved. So, you know, yes, the strong person can't lift his leg. But, you know, when you use that situation of feeling paralyzed or trapped to liberate yourself from your illusions, you know, you're on the path to awakening. It's a little, Zen is a little bit like, or life can be a little bit like this. You know, I hate it, I hate it, I hate it, I hate it. Oh, this is not so bad. This is not so bad. This is not so bad. And then, I am so glad to be alive. Thank you for my life. Thank you for my life. See, I think we go through that process again and again on the cushion. And that's, by the way, how Buddhas are made. You know, Buddhas are not produced by divine decree. There isn't a miraculous moment that makes somebody a Buddha. The Buddha didn't wake up in any other way than one nen at a time, right? Just like us. But he did wake up. It's just one breath. Take care of the next moment. Take good care of the next moment. Take good care of the moment after that. And that's the path to liberation. And I would say that's a path to liberation for humans, right? We have been told all kinds of wild stories, you know. Do this and you'll be a millionaire. Do this and everybody will be, you know. It's not working out that well. I think we need a different perspective. And let's start by liberating ourselves, and then, you know, we can make a difference. Sogen Osho asked, why is it that a person of great strength cannot lift his leg? And he also said, it is not the tongue that he speaks with. Mumon's comment, it must be said that Shogen shows us all his stomach and intestines, but alas, no one can appreciate him. And even if someone could appreciate him, let him come to me and I'll beat him severely. Why? If you want to find pure gold, you must see it through the fire. Mumon's verse, lifting his leg, he kicks up the scented ocean. Becoming one with this moment is like kicking up the scented ocean. Lowering his head, he looks down on the fourth jhana heaven. There is no space vast enough for his body. Now someone write the last line here. Even though it doesn't look like we have much freedom, even though we may be trapped in certain ways, you know, there is a kind of openness to life if we just know how to get access to it. And that acts, that freedom, we do have a freedom, and nothing can take it away, is that freedom to how will we greet the next moment? How will we be with the next Nen? So all of people here made the decision to come here and practice. That's how you decided to greet the next Nen. So thank you very much, and I hope I will see you soon.